and I see walking up a police officer. He comes to the door and he stands there and he says, I have something to tell you.
There's just no way to account for the way it changes your life. Some random event and everything's different.
This is just a tragic accident. Something happened, but that's not really what happened.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, we're back together.
Yes, we are.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
I know you love being in the studio with me.
I must love it. Yeah.
You know, Jim, we had some of our listeners on Facebook. Somebody was a hashtag Team Jim, which was very annoying. Hashtag I prefer Jim. And so I made a sarcastic comment about it. I was like, please, I'm not even telling Jim you hashtag I prefer Jim. And someone else put, oh, I hate it when you guys don't get along. And so I had to respond and say, oh, I'm sorry. We really do get along.
Teasing. Yes. Teasing is what you do.
Yes.
And I might engage in that a little bit. But Francie, today we have a very special guest.
We do.
Hi, I'm Jen Brown. And I love, by the way, you guys have your own hashtags. That's amazing. I love it.
So Jen, tell us who you are.
I am, my name is Jen Brown. I am a broadcaster, Emmy Award-winning broadcaster. Is usually what when someone asks me what the accolades are. So if you're asking, for me to tell about myself, I have been in the TV business for 15 plus years. I work in sports.
Incredible, because she's only 21 years old.
Yes, thank you.
I
know you guys can't see, but thank you. Yes.
Wait, Emmy Award-winning, Jen, I feel like Jen should be running this.
Really?
I think my job's in danger.
Are you planning on leaving? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's depending how today goes.
I'm not here to take anybody's jobs. I'm a big fan of the podcast, I'm just so appreciative to be asked to be on it. And I 15 plus years in TV. I work predominantly in sports, but for the moms out there, I used to host American Ninja Warriors. So those that have kids, I think, would maybe know me from that. But
Wait, I don't have kids. And I just want to make it clear, I'm a huge Jen Brown fan. In fact, I'm so sorry, American Ninja Warrior, but when Jen Brown left, so did I.
Sweet. That's sweet. Well, I still watch it.
It was
I had a couple of kids and that, you got to focus on them. But I love the show. It's such a great show and inspiration.
You said your broadcasting background is in sports. Why did you go into sports? I want to make sure our listeners know about that.
Well, it's interesting because I never intended to be in television. I was a criminology major in college, and I actually was on my way to law school. I had applied to 17 law schools. That's a whole nother story at a later date. But then had this little change and shift of an opportunity that came up to move to California and work in television. And it was that moment where I was like, well, let's try this. I can always go back to law school, but let's try this. And so I ended up in television. I was doing, I was producing and hosting a travel show. And, it's like kind of, hey, you just get out of college and it's like, get paid to travel around the world. Like I would pay to do that and not have someone pay me. And given my parents, my parents were Olympic gymnastics coaches, and I had played 7 sports in high school. I played softball in college.
Wait, what 7 sports?
Okay, I always make people guess.
She just said
curling, curling, pole vaulting.
No,
I'm gonna go with gymnastics.
Believe it? No. I actually was a junior Olympic diver, that was kind of similar to gymnastics. It's one of those things when your parents do something, you kind of don't want to do it, and you rebel a little bit. I was volleyball, basketball, softball, cross country, diving. Softball. Did I say softball?
You said softball.
Okay, wait. Let me go through the seasons.
Yeah, just curling is in there probably.
Well, here's the one.
Javelin.
There's one that's that I always get. So I was, there's a little tiny side story that goes with it. my senior year, I was on track to break the record at the high school for the most varsity letters. And I had already done 5 varsity letters. My junior year, I had every expectation of doing it my senior year. And then we got a new volleyball coach. And I would always do diving and volleyball in the fall. And I went to the new volleyball coach and she said, you can't be on varsity and miss practice. And so I was devastated because here I was on track to break this record. And just so happened that year we got a bowling team. And so it's like curling. I had never bowled, by the way.
I knew there was an ing there.
Yes, yes, there's an ing. I had never bowled except for like 12-year-old birthday parties. But for some reason, you know, I made the team. And so I did break the record. I had 14 varsity letters. So there's, wow. Yeah. So that's why, you know, as, to answer your question, Francie, when I was in television, I kind of started to gravitate towards sports, given my parents and growing up in sports, and then also just having played so many sports. And so that's, you know, that's where the TV career kind of, it took a shift. I was literally, I wanted to do what you guys do, to be honest. I actually had dreams of like, maybe I'd be an FBI agent, or
really?
I was...
Francie dreamed about that too. Unfortunately, it never came true.
But then I also had dreams of, you know, I worked at a law firm in the summers in college. I worked at a personal injury law firm in the nursing home litigation department. I found it incredibly fascinating. And you know, when we talk about my case, you'll understand kind of where that, you know, why that was something that I was interested in.
And tell me about your life and family at that time.
Sure. So my parents split after the, I always equate it to the Olympics because they were coaches. They split after the 92 Olympics. So it was me and my sister. I had a younger sister. Her name was Carrie. She was 5 years younger than me. We both lived with my mom in Orlando, Florida. And I was at the University of Florida going to college. I had just actually spent a summer in Spain, traveling abroad, taking Spanish and learning how to drink cervezas, is what I say. My mom laughs. She says, you went there to learn Spanish and you had fun.
Just had a say in touring.
Please give me a beer. Yeah. So I had just gotten back, actually. I had gotten back the night before. So I had traveled all day, got to spend the day with my mom and my sister, kind of catching them up on all the things that I did around Spain and giving gifts, and then went to a movie with my mom and my sister that night. And the next day was the first day of eighth grade for my sister.
Oh, wow. And so what were you doing actually when the case came to you?
So I was, my mom was out for the, she was out at work, I believe. And a friend of mine had come over to visit because I'd been gone for the summer. And we were out in the backyard, I think maybe in the pool. I can't remember that. I just remember going inside to get, I think, a glass of water. And I see through our, we had glass doors, and I see walking up a police officer. And he comes to the door and I meet him. He didn't even ring the doorbell. I meet him at the door and he stands there and he says, is Rita Brown here? And I said, no, that's my mom. He says, well, who are you? And I said, I'm Jennifer Brown. And he said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 19. And he says, I have something to tell you. Your sister Carrie, she was in a car accident, and right hit you. And then my memory of the rest is pretty good, but I remember looking at him and I'm like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, she was supposed to be on the bus, so Carrie doesn't get a ride home from school, and so she was supposed to be on the bus." And I said, "What do you mean she was supposed to be on the bus?" And he says, "Well, do you know Dennis Hill?" And I said, "Yeah, that's my sister's best friend's dad." And he goes, "Would he be able to identify your sister?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, well, I'm sorry. You know, she was in a car accident and she didn't make it. And so, you know, at that point, it's very fuzzy and kind of memory and obviously emotions. And he comes inside and it's a bit, I don't remember much. I remember, and here's what's very weird, is I remember the phone rings very shortly there after he comes inside. And it's, I can see on the caller ID on our home phone, it's my mom. And he tells me not to answer it at that moment, because I'm just now processing it.
Well, you're obviously in shock.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
That's why you're experiencing this fuzziness and you're having difficulty like actually focusing your mind. Everything is going crazy.
I'm trying to piece it together, you know, because it's first day of school. She's not supposed to be in a car with anybody. But here's what my mom leaves on the voicemail, and I'll never forget it, on the home answering machine. She says, hey, Jen, I just heard there was a bad car accident on Markham Woods Road, and I just want to make sure that Carrie got home safe. And like, she heard about my sister's car accident on.
Oh, terrible.
And so she was calling about to make sure, you know, just like, hey, just Carrie, see how Carrie's first day of school was, and mentions the car accident. And I just remember like, and then that point it was kind of logistics and how are we going to get to my mom? And we called my mom's longtime boyfriend, Mel. He's like a father to me, called him and I had to tell him, and then he had to go to my mom. And
where was your mom?
She tells this story, and I've heard her tell it. So that's how I know. She was like picking up a computer, and I know that Mel called her and said, "Where are you?" And she told him, and he said, "Wait there, I'll be right there." And then she said she knew she had a feeling of something was wrong. She actually thought it was going to be, she said, her parents, something to do with both of her parents were still alive, my grandparents. But she said that I've heard her tell this story, right? So he gets to her, and she looks at him, and she just says, "Who?" And he says, "Carrie." Mm-hmm. And then she just, you know, she loses it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, this is just so horrifying. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been through something, yeah, you know, similar, where they hear about a tragedy. And you were 19 years old. Mm. Your dad's not there. Your stepdad's not there. Your mom's not there. And the police officer, because you're an adult, mm-hmm, quote unquote, makes the decision to tell you that your sister has died in a car accident. I just think it's so horrifying. And I don't know how you process that as a 19, or as anyone really, but as a 19-year-old especially. I mean, this is your sister. What are you thinking?
I mean, I just remember, I think the first emotions that I went through was confusion, because it didn't make sense that she was in a car. And then obviously just a deep sense of loss. And we didn't talk about this, but I'll tell you, that morning, a different friend had come over to visit, and we were walking around. And I was telling her about I was like, "Okay, Carrie's at school. And now she borrowed like my shoes to wear to school today. And that's so cool. And, you know, she wants to go to Bishop Moore and she wants to break my record." And I kind of was just like, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm just like, so glad I have a sister to grow up with. Like, that's what, like, you know, and so it was just very, you know, odd that here I am earlier that morning, I'm just being appreciative of having a sister and thinking about us growing older together and thinking about, you know, that what that is when you have kids and it's your lifelong best friend, you know, to have that completely flipped on its head in the matter of hours later. It's just,
yeah, it's crazy how life works sometimes.
Yeah.
But the cop is there and you've now figured out how to notify your mother. What did you do next? Where's the next step?
Well, we learned a lot more pretty quickly thereafter. So it wasn't just my sister that was killed in the car accident. So let me tell you what I learned about what happened that day.
Well, how did you find out what the circumstances were? I mean, your sister was supposed to be on the school bus coming home and she wasn't.
Yeah, I think it must have happened a little bit later on once the crime scene was there for a very long time. So it wasn't just my sister who passed in the car. It was also her best friend, Amy. So the two girls died in the car accident. Amy's mother was driving, Mary Hill. And there was also another little boy who also lived in the neighborhood. That was my sister and Amy and Zach. His name was Zach. We're all best friends. And they were like the group together and they always hung out. And so Zach was sitting in the furthest away from the impact of with the car. And so he was air flighted out, was in a coma for a few days. So as I think, you know, the crime scene, I think my mom got stuck in traffic coming home because it's a two-lane road, mm-hmm, and it was a mile from our house. So she actually had to deal with traffic just to get home. And it took quite a while, I believe, for them to, because there was investigations and highway patrol and so much that went on. So we started to get, I think, more details of how, you know, why weren't they on the bus?
Well, was that information given to you by the police officer that's still at your house? I mean, you might not remember this because everything's fuzzy, but do you feel like your mom got home before you really learned much? Did you guys go somewhere?
I do. I think the next thing I remember, I get the news. I call Mel. My mom's now going to make her way over. And then I call my best friend, Courtney. And I know that Courtney and her parents were there. And she was who I had grown up as best friends since I was, you know, 8. I know her parents made it there before my mom got home. And I think it was just a lot of, I don't believe I got that much any information at that point from the police officer. I know that at some point, a woman came, which was probably an victim's impact. So I believe it was someone that was from the police station that was going to kind of help us through it all. And then, you know, and then my mom came. And then to be honest, all of the, you know, the next like real vivid memories I have is planning her funeral, really, you know, and then because it's hard to kind of, we obviously a lot of information. There was a trial. There was a very long process.
So tell us what happened. Tell us what you found out, that your sister was in the car with her best friend and another boy from the neighborhood. Our best friend's mother, she was driving?
The information that we got was they were on the bus, actually. And the husband His name is Dennis and Mary, the two parents of her best friend, Amy. They were, well, I'm going to tell you all of the information that I know, because there was things that we didn't know at the time. And then stuff has come out through 48 hours and through that. So apparently she was going to the doctor to be getting treatment, shock treatment for her depression, the mother. She was at the doctor that day. And apparently, according to the husband from his testimony on the stand, was that she was in a jovial mood because she actually found out she didn't need to get shock treatment that day for her depression. So they were on their way home. He was driving and he decided to stop and pick up the kids because they were the last bus stop. And that was actually something that had happened a couple of times. Parents would pick them up and or take them because it took a little bit long to get home from school. So they pulled them off the bus. And we just know that Dennis was driving. Mary was in the front seat and the three kids were in the back. My sister was in the middle. And they stopped at a gas station at this point that's probably about a mile and a half from our house to pick up another car that was being serviced. And so it was Dennis's car. We don't know what happened because we only have a little bit of his testimony that he spoke at trial, but he says she just got in the car and drove away. The next testimony we have is from a witness who was pulling out onto the road that she was driving down, who said that she almost hit them. So she was driving at such a high rate of speed that they weren't able to gauge and determine how fast she was going. She was going so fast, and by the time they pulled out, she was swerving around them. That car pulled behind her and proceeded to go down to the light, and that light was red, or turned red, you know, while she was approaching the light. And she actually couldn't stop and get it into the intersection. And then she had to back up. And when she backed up to get behind the line, because she was in the intersection and the light was now green for the other traffic, she almost hit the guy behind her, because this is a witness that talked at the trial. And then the witness actually says that he remembers seeing Zach turn around and look at him, almost like he said it was like apologetic, like so sorry kind of thing. Light turns green. There's another witness now at this point. There's a guy on a bicycle that's going the other way. And they both basically testify to the same thing, that the light turns green and she floors it. And it's, they hear the guy on the bike said he heard the revving of an engine even before, almost like a car about to race at a racetrack. And then the light turns green, she takes off. It's a turn. So it's not a straight, it's a turn. And she, I can't remember, it's maybe about 100 to 200 yards she goes. And from the highway patrol, they say is essentially, it's a 2-lane road. I think it was suggested 35 miles per hour. I can't remember, but it was 45 miles per hour speed limit. She swerves into oncoming traffic a little bit. And so she overcorrects. And as she overcorrects, that's when the car starts to slide. And then the car slid off the road and crashed into a tree. And if I remember correctly, there's different reports through the newspaper and highway patrol, but I think they say she hit the tree between 74 to 78 miles an hour.
Well, that's obviously far exceeding the speed limit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's crazy. I mean, obviously, Francie just said a minute ago that almost everybody's had that sort of experience where somebody notifies you something terrible happening. I mean, my family went through almost exactly the same set of circumstances recently, and the trial just concluded actually last week. But there's just no way to account for the way it changes your life. You know, some really unfortunate random event that, you know, a family member gets swept up into, and it just, and everything's different.
Yeah.
But so at this point, you know, and you've used the term a couple of times, which so would I, a car accident. And so most people think, okay, this is just a tragic accident. Something happened. She lost control of the car or was, you know, distracted and speeding. But that's not really what happened. Y'all, what actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power? Claims of miraculous trendy ingredients? Multiple modes? Well, if you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. And that's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses ensuring an even clean. And Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount, my favorite feature. These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice every day. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral health habits with Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/bestcase. This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better, but you have to go to getquip.com/bestcase to get your first refill free. Go right now to getquip.com/bestcase.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It wasn't really just an accident.
Yeah, so and this became a critical point in the trial that we just finished. But the definition of an accident is when somebody is, one, doing a lawful act, and unforeseen event intercedes and causes the collision. Doesn't seem like she was doing a lawful act. You're speeding almost 2 times the speed limit. That's not a lawful act. And any adult knows that if you speed, especially on neighborhood streets, that you're creating a risk to human life. So you said there was a trial, and who was arrested? Who went to trial?
Well, with your definition of accident, I guess that's what the district attorney, you know, the Florida prosecutors decided that it wasn't an accident and that there should be a trial. So I believe she was charged with 5 different counts.
And that's Mary.
Mary Hill, yes, the mother driving the car. She never said anything. We never got a phone call. But from what we gathered, because the trial was... I felt like the lead up to the trial was a couple years before it actually ended up happening. And it wasn't until in the opening arguments that from the defense that we learned that she was trying to claim that her car, the cruise control of her BMW, the car had engaged and it was a case of a sudden acceleration. And she was trying to claim that her car, without her doing anything, the cruise control engaged and then accelerated and she couldn't stop the car.
Now, one thing that I learned a great deal about is in the trial that we just finished was that BMWs have very sophisticated, you might call black box or chip, and it goes back 5 seconds from the accident and it solidly records all the functions of every working part in the car, every electronic part and even the the wheels and the steering wheel and the brake pedal and the gas pedal. Were they able to determine whether or not her foot was on the gas pedal?
Yes. So they had a BMW expert there who they were actually able to, the car was severely mangled. I remember seeing the pictures at the trial. The highway patrol could stand inside the indentation of where the tree was inside of the BMW. And the picture was taken from the back and you couldn't tell. You would have thought he was standing in front of the car on the other side. You couldn't see him. He was completely standing in the inside of the indentation. But they were still able to lift up the car and engage the cruise control and show that it was functioning properly. And they also spoke about the black box that you just mentioned in the trial and were able to show that there was no, quote, I believe it was like rogue signals. There was no faulty signals that would have shown that there was any malfunction with the cruise control. They had an expert, the defense did, that was a guy who kind of claimed that, you know, sometimes this just happens and it absolutely could have been this rogue signal that wouldn't have been caught up. It's defense. And so, but we had to sit through all of this, you know, and just listen. The one thing that I thought was very powerful, one of the biggest things that I remember, because we were just hearing this for the first time, right? Her car sped out of control, was the prosecutor, when she took the stand, and she did take the stand.
The prosecutor took the stand.
No, no, I'm sorry. When Mary Hill took the stand, excuse me, the prosecutor to Mary Hill said, Mary Hill, how long had we been talking to you about this accident? You know, you had many years we were talking to you and asking you what happened and everything. And so you're telling us that your car sped out of control and you couldn't stop it. She said, yes. He says, why in all of these years did you never tell us? And she just looked at them and she says, no one asked me. And I was just like, wouldn't that be the first thing that you would say to someone? My car, I couldn't stop my car. I don't know what happened, but I was trying to hit, because that's what she said on the stand. I was hitting the brakes. I was trying to stop that car. I couldn't stop it.
And did they actually have the information from the brake pedals?
I don't remember specifics. I know that there was a BMW expert who testified that every single thing was working properly.
Yeah, I mean, they have, not only do they have whether or not there's any pressure on the brake pedal, but they also will have indications of whether or not the anti-lock brake system engaged, all the different airbag control modules, all the different, you know, whether the steering wheel was turned, how many degrees it was turned, everything. And as well as whether or not there's any pressure on the gas pedal.
Or the gas, yeah. And I think it was brought up that there were some cases of BMWs having issues with a cruise control situation, and it had to do with a faulty cable. Mm-hmm. And it was in that her 7 Series BMW. There was a recall done, but her car had actually had it fixed. Mm. And so they were able to show that, you know, was working properly. I just know that BMW, it was just like, look, everything was working fine. There was nothing wrong with the car.
So the trial, that's, you hear that in the opening statements, that the defense is going to say the car went out of control. It's a car. The car caused the accident, not the defendant. What was the prosecution's argument of what caused the accident?
They were under the impression that Mary Hill was the reason why that car. So they charged her with 2 counts of vehicular homicide. They charged her with a lesser, I think, misdemeanor. I'm not sure exactly what those charges were. And then also, interestingly enough, they charged her with 1 count of child neglect. And the reason why for that was they wanted to have her husband testify. And because of spousal privilege, and in Florida, the term child neglect was so broad that because of what happened to Zach and he was still alive, they were able to say that that was child neglect based on the definition, which forced Dennis Hill to have to testify. But going back to the 2 charges of vehicular homicide, the argument was that because she almost caused an accident hitting the guy that was pulling out once, then she almost causes another accident when she gets to the intersection, backs up. Even if the car is not working at that point, you turn the car off, you take the keys out, you stop.
Correct. She had 2 prior warnings if that were the case. And she didn't do anything. She went on and continued to present a grave risk to human life by continuing driving that car.
And that was their argument, was that you had many opportunities to stop and you didn't. And 2 people died because of it.
Those are the theories at trial. What happened?
She got found guilty. She got found guilty in all 5 charges. What was interesting is that, so that 48 hours, I don't know if I mentioned this, but 48 hours was following the story. Mm. It was kind of a story of how well do you know your neighbors? Because we lived in a affluent neighborhood in Orlando, and my mom, Olympic gymnastics coach, worked with all these kids. And then here is her daughter, and you think that this is a normal family and you have good friends. And through 48 hours, all of these things came out, stuff that wouldn't come out in the trial.
Like what?
Family life, home life. They've got, apparently, you know, the husband and wife, Dennis and Mary, had a very not great relationship. She filed restraining orders. She, all these allegations of like sexual abuse. And then they ended up removing the younger daughter at this time from the family, Caitlin. There's actually an interview where apparently Mary Hill told her youngest daughter, 13, at one point, I wish you would have died in the car accident instead of Amy. And they asked her about that on camera. And it was, she was like, yeah, you know, I did say that. I regret it. And you know, and I think I should say this because I forgive Mary Hill. Mm. And I can't begin to imagine what she went through. I don't think that she, because of her carelessness, because of her making poor choices and whatever else went into her mental stability of what was going on in that car, my sister died. I don't think she did it on purpose. I think she made poor choices. And I think that she shouldn't have been driving. But I forgive her. And so even hearing her say that to her daughter, I would certainly could judge her in that moment, but I also don't know she lost her daughter as well. And whatever psychological things and stuff. But I guess we learned a lot. The nanny talked about her being addicted to controlled substances. The daughters of Dennis Hill from a previous marriage, her husband, talked about the daughter sat down and said, we always wondered when something like this was going to happen. So it sounds like internally in their family, she was kind of a ticking time bomb and waiting to go off.
And what did her husband say when he took the stand about what happened at that gas station? Why did she just take off at a high rate of speed?
He said that there was no reason. They were happy. She was in a jovial mood. I think those were his words, because she had just found out she didn't need shock treatment for her depression. And he had no idea. He was the second person on the scene. I don't know if this came out in the trial, but I read it in the transcript for a deposition from the witness, the guy that was in the car behind them, that was the first one on the scene. Dennis Hill walked up to her. She was thrown from the car, and he walked up to her and said, "What in the hell have you done?" It was not in a nice way. I mean,
it was accusatory.
It was accusatory. Yeah.
Well, you know, Jen, when I was Google stalking you, because I'm a fangirl from your American Ninja Warrior days, I did a lot of reading on this case, and I read, at least in one account, that there was some evidence, and I don't know if it came out of the trial or if it was just some of the stuff later or maybe in civil action later, where Mary Hill had threatened to, I can't remember whether it was wrap her car around a tree or kill their daughter, or that there was a shocking threat that she had made at some point that, at least in my mind, suggested possibly that she might have been trying to hurt her child or herself.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like to think that that's the case. I would hope not. What our feeling was is that she maybe got into a fight with her husband at the gas station, you know? Mm-hmm. And from the 48 hours and civil stuff, as you know, she had a history of driving really fast. Someone at the BMW shop says they replaced the rims on her car many times from running into things. And Dennis Hill's other daughter talked about how they would get in a fight with her dad and be flying down I-4 at over 100 miles an hour, way over the speed limit, and they'd be terrified, not knowing what she was going to do.
Yeah, well, it sounds like she has a history but it doesn't surprise me that her stepfamily said, we figured it was going to happen sometime.
Hmm. Well, so after she was convicted, what was the sentence?
Well, it was interesting. Because immediately once she's convicted, they obviously are going to try with the judge, because it would have been 15 years for each. So it would have been either consecutive or concurrent, right? Mm-hmm. And so she could have gone away for 30 years based on the two vehicular homicide charges. And they were trying to, the defense, you know, she's a first time offender. Then all of a sudden what they were trying to reason with the judge is saying that she was now, she was severely addicted to drugs and she had a severe depression. And they were trying to make the argument that when you're in prison, if I remember correctly, that you can't be treated for two things at once. And so, you know, she needed all this, you know, medical help, and that let the husband, and they have money, and let her, you know, be out and get the treatment that she needs.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I heard that in my career.
Yeah. And so, but it was interesting because now all of a sudden, you know, she's got all these everything was fine before the trial, but now all of a sudden she shouldn't go to prison because she's got all of these problems. And I remember feeling really helpless. I didn't know much about the criminal justice. I wasn't, you know, criminology, you know, all of where I've gone since then, but I didn't know much. And I just remember feeling so helpless in a lot of those moments because I didn't know if my sister was going to get justice. And I actually think subconsciously that's what sparked in me, you know, it created this driver in me to wanting to like make sure to learn and educate myself and help victims. And
sounds very normal. That sounds like a very good, actually, you know, forward thinking reaction. And it seems like it did motivate you to get into criminal justice.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I think there's many things that are terrible when people become involved through nothing that they did with the criminal justice system. It's such all the collateral difficulties and collateral tragedies. But the worst part is that feeling of helplessness that we hear from victims and survivors and family members and defendants' family members, to be fair,
sure,
all the time. And that is that the system is just so massive and bureaucratic and It takes forever. And it doesn't seem like the mechanism of justice cares at all about the people in the case. And that's one of the things I know Jim and I both dedicated our careers to trying to be different than that. But there is that churn, you know, there is that sense of this is one in 1,000 on my docket, you know, and so you try to treat each one as one, but you've got judges and juries and bailiffs and police officers and prosecutors and defense attorneys, and they're, it's all really just cogs in a massive wheel. And so it hurts me when I hear you say you felt helpless, because that's, it's horrifying. It's horrifying as a justice professional to hear that that's how you felt. You try as a prosecutor to make sure the people that you're trying to help never feel that way, but you obviously did. And it's terrible. And I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, I mean, I think it for us, thank you. I think it was the sentencing. It was because the judge actually, instead of sentencing her right away, gave her an opportunity to go to the hospital and be checked out. And so she goes down to Shands, and that took a month or so. So I remember we walked away being like, wait, is she not going to go away? Is she going to be let off and because she's addicted to cocaine or whatever her substance abuse is?
Because they're wealthy enough to take care of her at home?
Yeah, like, exactly. And so that was where I was really helpless, right? But interestingly enough, when it came back to doing sentencing, that's not the way it went. He actually, I remember, you know, the judge's words. He looked at her and he said, look, Mary Hill, I no doubt believe that you are depressed. You've lost your daughter. You know, I think they were also saying she was suicidal. They said she will take her life. He goes, I do believe that you're depressed. I do believe that you have gone through, but in the course that it has taken to get to this point in, I guess it had been maybe between 3 and 4 years, you've never once sought treatment for your substance abuse. You know, you've never once, you know, you're not trying to get yourself healthy. But now you want to be, you now you need all of this help, and I'm not going to buy it, essentially. And so she got sentenced to 15 years in prison. She did 15 years. She just got out last year. I think it was May of last year. And, you know, she was in her 50s when this happened, maybe even a little bit older, maybe 50s. But still, I mean, she went away for 15 years.
And did you get notification when she was being released?
My mom did. I believe the newspaper also reached out. But, you know, at this point, we as a family had just focused on healing. And we like to, you know, I don't think my mom made comments. I think she did her time. You know, that's what it is. You go to prison or jail, whichever it is, for the sentence. And I think that she hopefully did some good self-reflection and self-work in there. And I hope that her life is different now as she's out. And I hope that she's corrected the wrongs. And
well, you're a very good person for feeling that way. And that's great. And I think it's healthy to do that. And
well, it is, because I don't feel that way toward this woman.
I think you have to, right?
I guess. The whole forgiveness thing is generally beyond me. I always feel vengeful, and I'm sorry she's out of prison. I think that, well, I'm one of those people that always argued, you know, especially when you've taken a life, there is no term of years that is going to bring that person back to her family. And so I'm kind of an eye for an eye sort of biblical old-fashioned person.
I've had 15 years
good
to get
for you.
Here. You know, I probably was very much more of that eye for an eye very early on. But I didn't want to kind of, it was more for me, actually, to have how I can handle it and deal with it and move forward. And so that's what the choice that I made.
I think carrying around the hate and the vengeance is actually a weight on the person that's carrying it. And, you know, by forgiving someone, you actually relieve yourself of that.
Yeah.
And I think the universe deal with it.
I was able to then channel this into, okay, what can I do to help people? You know, we've talked a little bit about it. I have a passion for kids and being a mom and young women. Maybe it was because I didn't have a sister to mentor. So I, you know, when I was in college, I took a little time and actually started working with girls that were in foster care and kind of wanted to be a big sister to them. But they were, and it was unfortunate situations. They weren't just in foster care. They were either pregnant or had children and they were in foster care. And it was not usually from just a boyfriend. It was a bad situation from how they had a child. And so, you know, I doing things like that, allowing me to take, you know, a tragic situation and a loss and losing my sister, but being able to channel it into helping others doing something positive.
Well, that's really good. And we have the one final question to ask you. In your mind, is this a best case or a worst case?
Well, of course, I'm going to have to say worst case, just because I would give anything to have my sister back. So I wish that we didn't have to talk about it. So I would say it's a worst case. But hopefully maybe one day I could come on and talk about a best case of something. But yeah, this is my worst case.
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. But hopefully, you know, talking about it, the cathartic experience and having lived through all this, you've obviously come out of it with a good sort of sense of wanting to help other people. And that's always good. So I'm hoping that it kind of balances it out for you in your mind.
Well, and not only that, Jim, but we can tell our listeners that we're working on some projects with Jen in the crime space. And so she is interested in continuing to help victims and work on crime.
Great.
Well, and she wants to do it with us. I mean, really, it's with me, not with you, Jen. Just to be clear.
Of course,
you're
Francie.
Not supposed to.
Of course.
Because Jen hashtag prefers Francie.
Really? I don't know. I don't recall her ever saying that.
I know.
And you're putting words in her mouth.
I know. Putting her on
and
the
before
spot.
Before she gets a chance to, I want to say thank you, everybody, for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Till next time, signing off.